Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. My name is Corey Fleck, and I have another two-hour show for all of you. The first hour focused a lot more on the broad markets. We're going to bounce around, talk about some of the other major moves, including, or some other, let's call them significant moves in the bond market, also commodities, probably talk a little bit about currencies too. I am kicking off this show with Rick Bensignor. He is the president of Bensignor Investment Strategies, writes his institutional newsletter, Supposedly Irrelevant Factors, and also writes the In the Know Trader for the retail audience, and just started that new piece called 7-Eleven, where he picks no more than 7 of the 11 spider ETFs. Rick, before we get into actual market moves, I want to have a general discussion with you regarding the disconnect that we continue to see between, let's say, Main Street and U.S. equity markets. You and I were chatting before we recorded this about some of the businesses that were shutting down in our areas. You more in New York, me in Vancouver. We are seeing a lot of small businesses struggle, but you wouldn't know that. You wouldn't see that if you were just looking at the U.S. equity market. Look, this isn't new where markets don't exactly correlate to the underlying economy, but what's important to note about the disconnect currently here, Rick?
So, Corey, thanks for having me. I like the question that you're starting off with because there is this disconnect, very much so when you look at the, let's use the stock market and the fact that a week ago Friday, we were on all-time highs. And we're off, I don't know, 2/3% or so this week, nothing big. But, you know, to Main Street, when they turn on the TV or read a newspaper and they see where the market is, and they're probably like, going, what the heck's going on out here? You know, it's not reflective at all of my life, my family's life, my friend's life. You know, how can the market be saying things are so good when we're all struggling so much and so many small businesses are not going to survive this? I know in New York, they're already talking about 50% of the restaurants in New York City will close permanently. I mean, that's a huge hit on an economy. Closing New York City schools this week, as the mayor did, hurts those that have managed to survive because they need, you know, breakfast crowd, lunch crowd. And I'm not talking high-end restaurants necessarily, but just all the places that are categorized as restaurants in the five boroughs that make up New York. So you've got these large capitalized companies that go public and are publicly traded, and they're being very well bid up for. At the same time, things are very questionable about the economy. And it really is the difference in many ways of the haves and the have-nots. And the fact that the little guy is not represented in the stock market. These are big companies, and they are generally much more able to deal with problems like a global pandemic than, you know, the little guy who owns the hardware store around the corner, or somebody who owns a laundromat, or you know, people who, let's say small business America, you know, Main Street America, the little mom and pop shops that are so much the backbone of the country, are being dramatically affected by people staying home. People are staying home because by and large, they care about their health and they're trying to, you know, stay with guidelines that are being issued. Sometimes they're forced to by state or city mandates. Other times, you know, it's just people like, you know, my wife and I, we'll go out, we'll walk around the block and we'll go to the grocery when we need to get food, but we're not doing anything else. We're not hanging out with friends unless we're sitting outdoors. And now it's starting to get too cold in New York to do that. You know, we live a pretty quiet life right now because we're not going to the movies. We're not socializing and going out to dinner with friends, unless we can do so in a way that is relatively safe. And when you look at what's going on in the stock market, you don't see that because these are big companies and investors are looking past the pandemic at this point. They're looking easily 6 months to a year to 18 months down the road. And with, you know, vaccine breakthroughs, they're saying we know there's still trouble ahead, but we will get past it. And therefore, our stocks that sold off are, you know, so many of them are worth are value oriented names. There's we're seeing in the last week or two also the transition back into value over growth, something that has not worked at all for years. And you're at least potentially at a turning point in that longer term trend that suggests that you'll finally see more investors going towards cheaper names. In fact, this past week, when I did my weekly podcast for In the Know Trader, which I do on Tuesdays, and it comes out on, it's available on stockcharts.com at 3 p.m. Eastern time. And it also gets released at the same time onto YouTube. So if you do a search on YouTube for In the Know Trader or my name, Rick Bensignor, you will see, you know, every podcast I've done for the last couple of years. And as I say, they come out weekly. And in this week's episode, I actually spent the bulk of it talking about value names and looking at the list of maybe the top dozen or so names that were in the S&P 500 value index. I looked at the ticker IVE, which is an ETF, which is, you know, the S&P value, large cap value. And, you know, I went through a bunch of names kind of saying, here's where I like them, here's where I don't, because there is a move now into some value names. So you might as well kind of take a look at those charts for the first time in a long time and start bidding for some of the names that have been, you know, thrown out months ago and just made quite cheap in, you know, fundamental terms, and some of them just cheap in price terms too. So, you know, I bought a few stocks for myself, too. I recommended, you know, several of them. And I think this is the difference here between what you see as publicly traded companies and the belief by investors that a year from now will, by and large, be done with this virus. And therefore, they're looking ahead versus Main Street America, which says, you know, I can't look a year down the road. I don't even know if I can survive another 2 months in business. So there's a very different mind frame and sense of, you know, investing when it comes to even what individuals are doing versus what pension funds and corporations and hedge funds and mutual funds are doing, because they have different time frames and they're different markets. You know, you can't invest in Joe's hardware store down around the corner. You can go and buy things there, but you can't invest in it. And those who are in the investment industry are looking out ahead. We know the stock market is a forward-looking mechanism, and that's what they're doing. And so their investors in the stock market are trying to look beyond what's still ahead of us. And it's you know, kind of hard when you're living through the thick of this illness that and this virus that's going all over the place. It's very hard to when you're thinking, how am I going to feed my family? And put a roof over their head and send a kid to college and marry off my daughter. How do you do that when, you know, I don't know if I can survive another 2 months? So there is, it's a good question. There is definitely a difference between what investable securities are saying and what, you know, non-investable people who own non-investable stores are feeling.
Rick, do you see any lifeline being available to any of these companies, these smaller companies, either through some sort of government funding bill or who knows, people getting back to some sort of their daily life?
Well, today is an interesting day to ask that question, just given what kind of the main news story of the day is, and that Treasury Secretary Mnuchin has basically said he's ending many of these programs that were had money appropriated by Congress to help businesses. And he's basically saying there's still plenty of money left in that pot that hasn't been allocated or appropriated. And I'm going to return it to Congress. I have the right to do it. I've done what needed to be done. I heard him talk to Jim Cramer this morning and say, you know, look, Boeing, which could have gone under, we didn't, as a government, need to lend them a penny. They were able to get it through the capital markets themselves and private funding. And now, you know, the stock managed to, especially in the last week and a half, has really, you know, made a material move higher of probably 30% or so. And, you know, it was successful. And there's programs like that where we've turned the corner, at least economy-wise, And that's what our Treasury Secretary is essentially saying, such that I can take all these extra funds that haven't been dispersed yet and send them back to the government. And then in the future, Congress can reappropriate funds as needed. The left-leaning New York Times, you know, came out and said it's a very politically induced type move by the Treasury Secretary. I'm saying that it's simply a Republican move to make it more difficult for Democrats slash Biden to succeed in the future, to which Mnuchin said, not at all. This is not political at all. This is simply there's all these funds that have not been dispersed and we might as well, you know, give them back and let Congress reappropriate them at a future date if needed. The Fed's not happy about it. They came out with a statement, and Mnuchin and Jay Powell have gotten along quite well over time. But this is the first time where the Fed's saying kind of like, we wish you didn't do that. It's going to make it much harder to get money into the system down the road. But that's, you know, that's what's occurred. So is there going to be money in the system to help people in the future? I don't know. After today's announcement, I think Congress would do everything they could to reappropriate down the road. But it's kind of like, you know, anybody knows who's worked in a corporate environment. When budgets are filled out at the beginning of the year and resources allocated, many of the divisions that get those resources allocated will use them up purposely to make sure it shows that, you know, we asked for X amount of dollars, we got it, and we spent it. And it's much harder in the future to get that same money if you don't spend what you were allocated. And, you know, I kind of see this as a trickle through in the same way that Congress may make it tougher in the future if the Treasury didn't fully allocate all the money that was available to give out, it may be harder down the road. And I think that's what, you know, you're kind of seeing in the market. We're recording this late Friday afternoon. The market's closing in less than 4 minutes and the S&P is down 22 towards the lower part of this week's trading range simply because, you know, it's Friday and ultimately there's not good news going into the weekend. So to answer the question, is there going to be money going forward? I'd hope so, but I don't know if it's going to be readily available as it has been the last 6 months.
So, Rick, what is your outlook then for U.S. equity markets? Because reading over your newsletter, I know you made a fairly aggressive call just at the tail end of last week regarding U.S. markets that flies in the face of a lot of the bullish scenarios.
Yeah, so the markets closed all-time highs. And then I wrote my piece Sunday to go out to institutional clients, and I like to send it out late afternoon, early evening. And I purposely pushed hard to get it out before futures opened up at 6 p.m. Eastern time, just not to have whatever direction they were going to start the week off with affect how I was going to play this ball. But through a variety of things that I looked at, despite the market being on all-time highs as of a week ago Friday, I actually put out a call saying this is a very out-of-consensus call to hedge long portfolios here and now. And futures opened up well higher Sunday night. They even got an extra boost Monday morning from the Pfizer news. And I even sold something I rarely do, but I even sold futures for myself to hedge my own portfolio of stocks that, you know, I've amassed over 40 years of investing. And I didn't sell enough futures to fully hedge my book. I didn't want to do that, but I wanted to take some and say, you know, I'm willing to give up the upside, let's say, on a third of my portfolio. So I sell enough futures to equal that much. And all I'm doing is kind of hedging my long-term investing by saying here and now, I think the market can come off. And I've had some people say, you're crazy, we're going much higher. And yeah, we may go much higher. But through a variety of things that I looked at, I just didn't think that was the case, including if you think back to, so I guess it was two Mondays ago when the Pfizer news first came out. Then Moderna's news came out later in the week, and we kept pushing higher. But the Moderna news didn't take out the Pfizer news from a week ago Monday, where the S&P opened like 150 higher. And we only closed 50 higher on the day, but we had this massive gap up two Mondays ago. So I've been using that as a reference point because those highs in the S&P, and whether it was the cash S&P, the spiders, or the S&P futures, the spiders in the futures actually hit long-term upside targets that have been on my chart since the middle of 2015. I had a 36.62 upside target for the cash and 36.55 for futures. And we hit that in the futures and the spiders, which trade longer hours than the cash index, which is just normal New York Stock Exchange hours. So I hit these targets. This really good news comes out about a vaccine from Pfizer, and we have this huge move higher. And yet the subsequent good news that came out from Moderna and then again earlier this week from Pfizer didn't get nearly as high as the high from a week ago Monday. And I kind of anticipated that was going to happen, that the market had gotten as much good news as it could possibly get right now. And when the second wave of good news came and then the third wave of good news, all relating to vaccines, came out, they still couldn't take out the high from the first good news. And I kind of anticipated that to happen and that people are leaning the wrong way right now. So that's what got me to kind of come out with the hedge. And the S&P is only down 35 points or so on the week. So it's not, it's 1%. It's not a big decline. But there are times I can kind of see where I think it's the right time for institutions to sell some futures or sell spiders, or for individuals to lighten their books to play for some type of decline. So that's what I'm doing now. And, I have the luxury of luckily having put these hedges on the day that made the highest, the all-time high. So I have flexibility here that anywhere I cover these S&P futures lower than I sold them makes me money on the future side. But of course, my book of long stocks is truly losing money. So the hedges there to offset some of the loss. But for right now here, I thought that this was the right time and place to do some selling in the S&P. So that's why I've done it.
All right, fair enough. Let's also talk about commodities. And starting off, let's talk broadly, because right now, base metals, they went through a fairly important, I think, significant breakout, especially copper, just on Friday. It's been creeping up for months now, but it reached levels that it hasn't seen since 2014. What is copper and the broad rise in base metals telling you about the underlying markets and money flows?
Well, so here's the same thing. Those markets, some people call copper Dr. Copper. I think that name came out in the 1980s, that it is one of the truest signs of the health of the economy. If you look at a chart of copper, it bottomed in March. It made its highest highs, as you say, in several years this week. And so it's very much kind of followed what stocks have done. So if I look at a chart, I see 2018 front month copper got to 320 or so. So we're right there. 330. And today we got to just about 330 also in December futures. It is suggesting that the economy will do well over time. China is the largest buyer of copper in the world. For quite some time, they've had massive inventory, so that they haven't needed to buy. But when I look at the chart, that copper got down to about 210 or so in March, and now it's 330. It's added 50% of its value since March, and which is more than, stocks got to what, 20, where did the S&P get, 2,500 or so, 2,400? So they're not so different in their return and even what the charts look like. So the charts would suggest that the economy down the road will do well. But the other side of this that doesn't get talked about by the media, they'll just headline, copper's making highs, is how much commodity markets are fueled directionally by funds that trade them. And most of the funds that trade directionally in commodity markets are pure momentum plays. They generally don't buy sell-offs. They buy rallies and they sell to clients. So they go with the direction of the general trend. So a lot of the buying that's being done in copper now is not because copper is the tell-all end-all or where that means the economy is going to fly. It's simply funds that come in and allocate to the copper market, X percent of the money they have available, and they may sell out of something else to put money in there, or they might have idle cash. But when you see a commodity that looks, straight up as copper has done since the March low, you're going to see more and more funds be a part of this. So part of it is, in general, the copper market is saying things are improving down the road. But the other piece is how much the funds push these markets.
How about the funds pushing some of the other metal sectors like precious metals or anything else that you're seeing in the metal sector?
Yeah, so gold peaked several months ago over the summer. And at the time, we identified and said that we think the peak is in for the rest of the year. At first, I said it through Election Day. And then about 2 weeks before Election Day, I said, I think gold is likely done on the upside for the balance of the year. Long-term targets in gold are still well higher. Shorter term, it's had some trouble. But most importantly, it still stays above 1835. We keep bottoming somewhere around 1850, and we get some bounce. So right now we're at December futures are at 1871. So we're only a little bit above, the support level. If we start breaking under 1835, next level is probably 1760, 1770, something like that in there. And then the big support level, which if we got down to is going to hurt a lot of people who are long gold, is all the way down at like 16 and a quarter. And that's where, like on the charts, I come in again with what we call in the business, two hands open. Like I'd buy a lot of gold at that point down there. In between, I'm long some gold myself. I sold out of half. I still have half. I'm trying to figure out if I want to live through a potential $200 decline or not. Because if I sold out, then I got to figure out, all right, let's say I sell out and it goes higher. How do I get back in? It's tough buying stuff near all-time highs. At least me as a counter-trend trader, that's a hard thing to do. So for now, I'm sitting with it. And a lot of it's going to have to do, Corey, with the dollar. The dollar is still holding above its long-term support line. So for those of you who are listening and have access to the U.S. dollar index, DXY, on most charting systems, if you draw a trend line back from the secular low in 2011, we are somewhere in the upper 91s is that trend line. And we have bounced off of that so far. And for a couple months, we continue to hold support there. If the dollar gives way and breaks down further, then in 2021, I could see it easily going to 87.5. And that's been my downside target in the dollar. So I recognize that, it's going to hold here in the low 90s for a while. But if it breaks, then gold is good. Silver is good. You'll even see perhaps platinum finally come into the foray of being, breakout to the upside. That has stalled multiple times in at around $1,000 and couldn't break out. But now we're still, I see today, kind of impressed when I look at the platinum chart, platinum's back to 950-ish. And I wouldn't have thought that just based upon how much it had gotten trashed recently. So if the dollar falls, precious metals will do well. If the dollar ends up holding here in the low 90s and you get a move up to 95 or 96, they're going to hit the metals hard. And that's where you're going to see pain. And I almost think that might happen just simply to wash some people out, wash weak-handed longs out of the picture. Now, I don't generally talk about Bitcoin. It's not a product. I don't care anything about the cryptos, but it's hard not to recognize that today, Bitcoin is over 18,000 and challenging its all-time highs. And if Bitcoin is doing that, then maybe gold won't fall a heck of a lot, because any of these, a cryptocurrency, or let's call it an alternative asset to actually holding dollars, if Bitcoin's doing this, maybe the dollar just is not going to get a major rally. It's kind of what Bitcoin players are implying by bidding it up to the levels it's had. So it's had a big breakout in the last 2 months that once you got above, I guess, about 10,500 or so, to be at 18,000 this quickly is rather significant. Now, I'm not suggesting your listeners play this market. I don't play cryptos. I don't know if I ever will. But for the time being, I'm not interested in them. But it is, I'm pointing out the fact that $18,000 Bitcoin is something I can't, and it's 18.6. So it's not something I can ignore.
Okay. Hey, Rick, great having you on the show. We covered a lot there, and I think kind of that balance, too, in that first segment about what the disconnect between markets and the underlying economy. That's a key thing to understand, and to understand that stuff like that can continue. Rick, great having you on the show, buddy. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend. Thanks again for your time.
Thank you, Corey. Stay well.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the first hour of the weekend edition of the KE Report and continuing our focus broadly on the markets and diving into a couple individual sectors. I hope everybody enjoyed those first two segments with Rick Bensignor. In this segment, I am featuring Dana Lyons. He is a fund manager based out of Chicago. And Dana, you and I chat pretty much every 2 weeks. And I think it's important right now to go back 2 weeks and recap some of the stuff you were outlining, some of the factors and the models that you were watching post-election. Now, the last time we chatted, I think it was just a day or two after the election, and you were sharing some of the positions that you guys were taking. You had outlined that breadth looked good. You had started to really load up on the markets, and quite frankly, that strategy has worked very nicely. Give us a little bit of a recap from 2 weeks ago and what we've seen so far in these markets and some of the positions you've taken.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Corey. Always good to be on your show. Yeah, so I'll backtrack even a little bit further. Maybe in August, we started seeing some breadth warnings, some warnings in our risk model. We call it an intermediate term risk model. It's comprised of a number of indicators. A lot of it has to do with the breadth in the market. So how many stocks are moving up versus moving down in a broad sense, a lot of proprietary computations. But in a broad sense, a lot of breadth indications. In August, it started thinning out despite the continued rally in the large cap averages. And so we pulled in our horns a little bit. And in September, we saw a pullback. And we frankly, we expected our model, which turned positive in April, we expected to get a sell signal. But funny thing happened in early October. It actually, we saw breadth market internals and an array of market sectors and segments actually rejuvenated and kind of started to take off to the upside again. So we saw an expansion in breadth. We saw some breakouts in some of the smaller and mid-cap areas. Some of the lagging areas started to catch up. So far from giving a sell signal, it actually our model firmed up quite a bit. So that was a key moment, I think, in terms of this rally, was that first half of October. And then the second half, I think, was all about sentiment got a little ramped up into mid-October, a little too much bullishness. But the rest of October was all about kind of a relaxation of that sentiment, a little bit of pulling back in the rampant bullishness. And then also most of it was about a spike in fear, a bid in volatility expectations, all surrounding the election. So you saw the bid in volatility. I think a lot of people extrapolated it to overall general market fears. But I think we looked at a few research pieces that we did back in the time, and it suggested that, no, it's all about the election. Once you get past there, there's no indication of any, you know, volatility bid necessarily. So building up, we had that pullback in right into just before the election. We had kind of a perfect storm of a buy signal for us. We had increasing bearish sentiment. We had spike in fear. We had on the charts, we had a technical pullbacks back towards key support levels in a wide array of sectors and indices. And then at the same time, you had this underlying improvement in the market internals and the breadth of the and then the foundation of the stock market. So I think, well, a lot of people I heard was, and the pundits on TV was, watch out for a spike in volatility, some market chaos if we have this disputed or unresolved election. And just looking at the market indicators, it was about as clear and as rampant a bullish signal as we've gotten in a while. So, yeah, we loaded up right before that Wednesday to Friday, right before the election. And, you know, obviously 2 weeks later, the rest is history. We've had about the best post-election rally ever. So not to toot our own horns. I think the point is that I would make is, if you're when you're making investment decisions, it's best to rely on the quantitative objective data coming from the market itself, rather than, you know, trying to forecast and predict based on exogenous events like the election and what's going to happen in the aftermath and other, like you mentioned off the air, you know, various fundamental pieces of data that typically don't change until well after the stock has turned. So I think, the point being, you know, the data was pretty clear to us that it was a great buying opportunity right before the election. And again, the last 2 weeks would bear that out. And at this point, obviously you're late to the game, but there's no evidence yet to suggest that, you know, the move is necessarily over.
Hey, good job on that trade, though, Dana, because even as you've outlined it, the market rally has really flown in the face of a lot of the fear that we were hearing about, riots and a contested election. The fact of the matter is the market went up, about 12% in 2 weeks. That is a very fast move. But now that leaves the question of, what do you do now? You said, fine, yeah, you might be a little bit late to the party, but your data is still looking fairly positive currently, isn't it?
It is. The breath measures have not relaxed at all. It's still very firm. And the other, that plays into another consideration that gives people opportunity right now still. And that's the expansion in the number of groups that have participated. So you have some of the older relative strength areas that have been moving well since the March low, even before that, stuff like healthcare and technology, some of those leaders that really peaked out in maybe the early September. And basically have gone sideways. They've consolidated over the last several months, which is not unhealthy after you have a huge run. So those are primed, we think, for another upside resolution and another upleg, even as some of the newer relative strength areas that have run so much over the last couple of weeks and since early October, they're playing catch up. Maybe they're getting a little bit extended. So. Our tact has been to take a little bit of profits off the table in those newer areas that got extended over the last few days, and rolling a little bit back into those older relative strength areas that, by just a glance at the headlines and some Twitter stream and stuff, it looks like a lot of people are trying to write off technology as kind of the dog has had its day and it's doomed from here. We don't see that. We think it's had a nice healthy consolidation and it's got it's put itself back into position for another run. Same thing with something like biotech. Is broke out to new highs a couple months ago and has consolidated for several months. I don't see anything unhealthy about that. The healthy thing is that money is rotated elsewhere, even as those sectors have held up well. So it's been a very good, it's probably the best trading environment we've seen in a long time. Whether you're talking about the array of areas that have been good performers, or the fact that they kind of ping pong back and forth. The newer stuff will be have a good day as the older relative strength stuff kind of stagnates, so you can trim some, add to the other, and it kind of goes back and forth. So Nothing unhealthy about that. In fact, it creates a lot of opportunities, and I think there's still opportunity there.
Yeah, and you know what? That's actually the sign of a very healthy market, right? And even to your point about tech and people saying the tech day is over, we have to remember tech was doing well before the pandemic too, right? So most people were pointing to some sort of government regulation that could throw tech off, and who knows, we still might get that, but hard to bet on something like that happening. And even when we have seen governments step up to some of these big tech companies, they have more or less weathered that kind of negative storm. Let's talk about some of the other lagging sectors, though. We have seen money broadly kind of flow out of some of the safer sectors. You and I talk about gold and gold miners. Those have been correcting, especially gold miners. They've been correcting for 4 months now. We're heading into the end of the year, typically a sign of or a seasonal weakness period for the gold miners and gold price. Are these stocks, are the gold miners finally getting to levels where they're attractive again for you?
They're getting close. Our take, as we've discussed many times, is the precious metals complex is in a bull market. We deal in ETFs, so we're long GLD, SLV, GDX, that type of thing. Well, GLD ran up a couple months ago. I think it was in August, maybe topped up. Ran up right up to those highs from 2011. Okay, so we took some profits off the table there. We expected, at least we hope for a nice, healthy consolidation, kind of give the sector a chance to refuel for a more healthy and sustainable breakout when it does try to break out to new highs. And that's what's going on now. We've seen that for the last 3-4 months or so. And again, I don't think that's unhealthy. We'll add back those profits that we took out, what we're looking to add back, starting with a little bit, maybe just below here, around 172 on GLD. And then if we break down further, we've got levels below that too that we would add to. But I don't think it's like technology and healthcare that we talked about. We had huge runs. You can't expect things to go up forever. The way they consolidate, the way they handle it when they stop going up is your key. If they go sideways, that's healthy. It suggests a continuation pattern, another upside resolution, another up leg. If they collapse immediately, well, maybe that's the end of the story, the end of the road. We haven't seen that in technology, healthcare, and we're not seeing it in the precious metals market. We're getting a good pullback, sure, but one that we expected. And you look at the gold miners, GDX, for example, ran up right almost to that 61.8% retracement from the 2011 high. The Fib retracement almost ran up to that right to the penny back in early August as well, and has consolidated from there. It's been a nice, healthy pullback, and now we're looking to add back some of the exposure that we took off back then at resistance. So I don't think I don't see any reason, any evidence yet why the precious metals bull market is over. Just at this point, it looks like a healthy consolidation, healthy retracement, and maybe even a bull flag. So we expect eventually another up leg to this.
Okay. Final comment. Let's also talk about copper. Not a metal that we have talked about regularly at all, but at the end of this week, copper went through a pretty significant breakout. Is this something you're buying into? Do you see this being sustainable?
Yes, for the intermediate term, which again, it's basically our time frame that we deal with in investing. Is basically call it 2 to 6 months, and it could extend from there. But at this point, are we buying here? No, but we bought, we had a pretty significant breakout, I guess, in September, and came back. I guess earlier this month, maybe end of October, early November, came back, tested that breakout level, which is where we did buy into copper. And at this point, I think seeing some, getting close to really some profit taking this point in copper in the near term. But in the intermediate term, like I said, no reason to think this can't continue even higher, even though, relative to 2011, certainly hitting hitting lower highs, but we are long copper, and we think the intermediate term should have more upside to it.
Hey, Dana, it's great having you on the show, buddy. Thank you for more or less the recap of the last couple weeks and some of the positions that you have been in. Dana, great chatting with you, buddy. Have a great rest of your weekend.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, Corey.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Corlin Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Here we are to wrap up the first hour of the weekend edition of the KE Report. I am chatting with Mark Chandler. He is a managing partner over at Bannockburn Global Forex. Also writes the Mark to Market blog that I read over pretty much every day. And Mark joins me pretty much on a weekly basis to recap the news events and some of the key events to watch for in the following weeks. What I want to talk about here, Mark, is how the recent vaccine news has changed money flows within the markets and overall sentiment of investors. We're not going to get into the logistics around a vaccine or really anything about the vaccine, more so market moves. And let's start off with the rotation that we've seen. FANG broadly has underperformed for the last 2 weeks as we have seen that money rotate in some of these lagging sectors. Let's start there. First of all, how sustainable do you think this rotation is? And do you think it's warranted, the rotation out of FANG into these lagging sectors because of a hope of a vaccine?
Yeah, sure. I think, you know, it's probably at this point, it's probably more than just a hope of a vaccine. The results are promising, and at least two of the companies, right, Pfizer and Moderna, are applying for this emergency use. So things are looking positive. I think that the markets, the important thing I think to take away is the markets are anticipating. So they like price in the probability of a scenario. And the scenario is that the vaccine will be available. And that even though in the short run, Europe, the U.S., North America, many other countries are still having a surge of the virus. So they're trying to look past this near term and what would be the implications. And so besides like what you're identifying, the shift out of things, one way to think about it is for so long, how long have we been talking about it, that the value has underperformed growth. And so the idea would be that maybe there's a catch up. So broadening of the market. So you look at something like the Russell 2000, having done better than some of the major narrower indexes, especially those that capture the things. The other thing I think that people are doing is they're concluding that if growth is going to be better, that is, if we get the vaccine, we can begin going back to normalizing things, then the chances of some countries like the UK or New Zealand adopting negative interest rates has declined. And so we've seen both of those currencies, sterling and the New Zealand dollar, respond positively. We've seen the optimism of the vaccine and what that could mean going forward, reducing the need for safe havens. So we did see gold, for example, sell off. I think this is a first back-to-back week loss in gold in about 3 months. And we've seen the yen actually, the dollar jumped from about 103.30, the low, like 8 month low against the yen, to 105.65 last week, purely on the idea that we don't need the safe haven anymore. This week, in recent days, we've sort of retraced some of that, consolidated those dollar gains. But in general, the market's concluding with a vaccine, less need of a safe haven, less need for other countries to adopt negative interest rates, less need to at least begin taking profits on some of those stocks that benefited from the stay-at-home work environment.
So, Mark, don't you think some of these conclusions that the market's coming to, like a lack of negative interest rates, are getting a bit ahead of themselves? Because if we go back to, let's say, the end of last year, we weren't hearing from central banks saying they want to be raising rates. We were still hearing that central banks were generally concerned about the underlying economy. And now that the economy has really just gotten crushed, and yeah, fine, if we do get a vaccine, why all of a sudden does the economy come screaming back and governments or central banks start to raise rates?
Yeah, it's not so much raising rates. It'd be more like countries like the Bank of, like the UK or New Zealand, that were near zero, and the market was pricing the likelihood of negative interest rates. But I hear what you're saying too, that the market, sometimes we do this, I think, that we tend to truncate time. And that is to say that before we get to the vaccine, that is as early as next month, we should expect further easing by the European Central Bank. And in recent days, the speculations increased the Federal Reserve will do something next month as well, and that something else is shifting the bond buying towards the longer end of the curve. And of course, we're going to get more fiscal stimulus too, though it's not clear exactly when, but it's going to be coming in the U.S. It looks now, I mean, the odds of a lame duck stimulus package were never very great. So above zero, it does look like we have to wait until a new government comes in to get that fiscal stimulus.
Exactly. So that'll be in about 2 months' time, just under 2 months' time. But then why are safe havens selling off if the outlook is still for more government spending, more fiscal stimulus, don't you think? Or doesn't it seem like some of that money should land in some of these safe havens when you consider just how much debt countries have? And the fact of the matter is that they can't withstand substantially higher rates.
Yeah, I think that, like I say, the market kind of like compresses time, and then later we'll make these like more nuanced adjustments. But I do think that you're right, that we've got still a long slog ahead of us to get there. And what the markets, I think, are saying is that even though we get the vaccine, that we shouldn't expect that even, and countries have more debt, the debt servicing costs, the larger debt, more than offset by lower interest rates. And so the servicing the debt is not going to be a major problem. And that's one of the highlights of this past week is China. They've issued euro-denominated bonds last year. They came back to the market this week, offered a new euro bond, several different tranches. It's a five-year tranche. China was able to sell at below zero interest rates. And so at domestically, China's 10-year government bond is about 3.3%. So they were able to raise money at less than zero. And I think this is what people are seeing. Like Italy has been able to raise money at less than zero. That the debt servicing costs led us to continue this game for a little while longer.
Is there just that much money out in the world then that people are struggling to find anywhere to place it, and they're still willing to put it in negative yielding bonds? That's crazy to me.
Yeah, I hear you. I think you just have to think about the huge size. I mean, of the money. So imagine you've got an Italian bond and it's coming due. And so the tendency is just to roll it over in those Italian bonds. And so there's some of this captive money. But I think that, to your point, this is why some currencies have done especially well recently, beyond what the economics would suggest, like Mexico. The Mexican peso is one of the strongest currencies in the last 6 months. But it's not because the domestic economy is so strong. It's because they have their 3-month T-bill. The CETES yield about 4.25%. So money is drawn to that, to Mexico, not because of progressive policies and a strong economy, but simply because of that circuit of capital and that chase of yields.
How does this all play into the yield picture here in the U.S.? Because we have seen, especially the long end, grind higher. I'm not saying that it's screaming higher, but it is generally grinding higher. You look at the last couple of months and the trend is definitely up. So it does play into the whole shying away from safe havens. But how sustainable is that increase in the long end if even you are correct, where the Fed shifts some of its focus to buying longer dated bonds?
Yeah, no, I think you're right that it is true that U.S. yields have crept up. You know, initially, after the election, and then again when the Pfizer's announcement, people put on this, like, it looked like a reflation trade, That is, they sold the long end of the U.S. curve. And yet what's happened in, I'd say, the last few days, and yields this week in the U.S., those 10-year yields, benchmark is down about 7 basis points, which is among the biggest declines in the world after, of course, being, leading the way up. But that the new sort of scenario that has replaced the reflation story is the idea that the Federal Reserve will buy more long end. So you don't want to be caught short when the Federal Reserve announces, if they announce, that the Fed's going to concentrate its gunpowder on the long end of the curve. So rather than reflation, people are looking at more central bank bond buying. And that's what Australia announced earlier this month. This is what the UK has announced this month. And we'll expect the ECB to do the same thing, step up their bond buying next month.
How does that hold down inflation or this reflation trade if the government's buying longer dated bonds, keeping rates generally lower, and you also see some of the moves that we've seen in oil, copper, other base metals, even steel? Those are breaking out, and that is a sign of a potential reflation or inflation trade?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point, and that's what's happening, and I think that the central banks should have welcomed that. Remember, even before the recovery, many countries, Japan, Europe, the U.S., the U.K., Canada, were all sort of not plagued, but definitely bothered by the low inflation. And so officials want to see inflation. I'm not sure that higher commodity prices are going to be more than an inflation scare, because it seems to me that most of the, when it comes to commodities, higher prices tend to be come from supply disruptions rather than a surge in demand. What's happening now, though, is there is a demand function, and I think that the demand function is coming from China, whether it's soy, whether it is copper. China seems to be having an insatiable demand right now, building up stockpiles. And the same thing, I mean, the idea that we could get back to normal, I think it also helped oil prices. When I say oil is up like 15% or so in the last few weeks. And so I think this is partly part of the story of the reflation trade, and that by yield staying low, nominal yield staying low, what happens is, I think this is a big boost to extend and strengthen the economic recovery.
All right. Well, hey, we'll see how this all plays out, right? This is still very much a moving target and a lot of forward looking, but that's what the markets do. And the markets are telling us in a number of different ways that the economy is going to get back on track. It's hard for me to believe it right now, as we are living through a time when, in all fairness, more restrictions, more lockdowns are coming, but who knows? Hopefully some vaccine news just gives governments the confidence to open stuff back up. In terms of news next week, though, Mark, wrap us up with what you're going to be looking for, what you think matters.
I think there's one data highlight for everybody, or for all the major countries. And I'd say that's going to be the first look at the Purchasing Managers Index readings for the month of November. And as you know, Europe, risks have increased that Europe has a new contraction this quarter after a big rebound in Q3. The Bank of England's forecast in the UK economy contracts by 2% this quarter. And we should begin seeing this reflected in the PMIs. So I'd say major countries, watch for the PMI readings, likely to be consistent with a market slowing down of the economies due to the reaction to COVID.
All right, Mark, we're wrapping it up there. Again, you can check out Mark's daily notes at mark2market.com. I will post a link in that weekend show posting on our website. Everybody, I hope you enjoyed this first hour. I'm coming back on the second hour with a bit more of a focus on the metals sector, diving into some of the companies, some of the analysts that I have on, and some just broad updates. That whole hour can be found on our website, kereport.com. Mark, great chatting with you, buddy. Thanks for your time again this week.
Thanks. Good luck, everybody.